We're going to start the program today talking about the new jobs numbers out today. The economy added 288,000 jobs. That's better than analysts expected. The unemployment rate dipped to 6.1%. We're wondering about who's finding work and who is still struggling. The unemployment rate actually went down for women and African Americans, but the rate actually went up for one group that might surprise you, and that is teenagers. And some economists point out that many young people still aren't even counted in those numbers. Here to talk more about this is Marilyn Giwak. She's NPR senior business editor. Back with us. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Hi, Michelle.
Also back with us once again, Sudeep Reddy. He's an economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Michelle.
So, Marilyn, where was most of the growth, and why did the unemployment rate go down for Black people and for adult women?
Well, this was a really good report, first of all. And let's just say that, you know, economists were making estimates, and this blew by pretty much everybody's estimates. And the gains were across the board. But what helped women and minorities were some of the hiring was most intense in education, health care, the public sector, hospitality, taverns, all kinds of things where a lot of times women are concentrated in those kinds of jobs. And so they benefited. Men were finding work in construction, or not so much construction as manufacturing, transportation, and warehouses. So they gained too. Everybody came out better, but it really perked up the most for people who were in those more of those public service, education, healthcare jobs.
Sudeep, anything you want to add to that and anything you want to point out about who's being left out? I just note that the report says the rates for adult men, whites, Hispanics showed little change, and the jobless rate for Asians little change from a year earlier. Anything you want to add?
Well, Marilyn's right. Mm-hmm. We're seeing remarkably steady gains in jobs across the board. It's been a steady half year so far, and we're just going into the sixth year of the economic recovery now. We just passed the five-year mark. You would hope that once you're at this point, you'd see a lot stronger gains. This is a recovery that has been frustratingly slow. We've all felt it along the way. What you're still seeing is there are millions and millions of people who are being left behind by this. Of the 9 million people who are still unemployed, a third of them have been unemployed for 6 months or more. That is a very long time. And a lot of people who have been unemployed for a long time end up dropping out of the labor force. That's one of the numbers beneath the surface you see. Labor force participation has been dropping. It's at a 3.5-decade low. That is a really concerning thing in the long term for the labor market when people just give up hope and leave.
Marilyn, you've been telling us repeatedly that there has been growth, but it hasn't been enough to kind of soak up the people who have been unemployed for a long time. And we're also seeing evidence that people who, for some reason, people who've been unemployed for a long time seem to be discriminated against in the job hunt, that they seem to be less likely to get employment the longer time goes on. Do we see any evidence that the growth is starting to finally kind of impact the people who've been long-term unemployed?
I think maybe we really are at that tipping point when you look at these numbers. You know, it was in June, July of 2009, 5 years ago, right around this time, that we finally tipped from when things were just falling straight down to finally starting to bounce back up. It took a long time from that point 5 years ago to get to where we are now. Now, we've basically just been grinding our way out of this deep hole, but now we seem to be poised for growth because what's happening is, while Sudeep's certainly right about there are all these people who are still unemployed, a lot of employers are really realizing, they're looking around and saying, hey, I actually need more workers. A lot of people are going on vacation. They want to, you know, hotels are hiring, restaurants are hiring. So you're really starting to get people back into the workforce that'll start to absorb these people who have been on the sidelines. And that's going to help do a couple of things. It'll draw some people back out of that pool of long-term unemployed, but also wages are going to have to start to go up. We really haven't seen wage growth, but at some point, if you want to hold on to your best workers, you're going to have to offer more. And we just saw in recent weeks both Gap, you know, the Gap with all its stores, and IKEA.
The retailer.
The retail stores, they're starting to raise voluntarily, saying we're going to start paying more than $10 an hour. And as soon as they announce that, they're starting to see more applicants, people who are teenagers who say, it isn't worth it to try to get to work. I can't afford the clothes. I can't afford the gas. I can't afford to get there. maybe at $10 an hour, now you're thinking, well, actually, I could afford that bus fare, and maybe I will come into the workforce. So what you've got to see is this continuing growth in employment to start to get the long-term unemployed back into the workforce and to start to draw some of these people who are on the sidelines back into working. But that's going to take some wage gains, and maybe we're going to start to see a little of that.
If you're just joining us, we're digging into this month's jobs numbers. We're speaking with NPR senior business editor Marilyn Geewax. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal. Sudeep, dig into that a little bit more, the picture with young people, if you would. Marilyn was just saying that, you know, we've talked a lot about the employment picture among young people. We found that it used to be customary for teenagers to work in the summer. Now we find that far fewer are working in the summer. What's the picture now?
Far fewer are working in the summer. Mm-hmm. Far fewer young people who are enrolled in college are actually holding jobs than they were before. Perhaps it's because they've got student loans to back them up and that's available to them. But we're still seeing, even while the economy recovers and the labor market recovers, one of the last groups to recover is going to be younger workers. And that's just by virtue of the fact that a lot of the people who are on the sidelines who are looking for work tend to be more experienced. They tend to have skills already that employers are going to want, and they're not necessarily looking for huge wages. We've all heard stories of people who have taken pay cuts to go back to work, and just because they will take a job that's available to them. And when you have people doing that, that leaves fewer job opportunities for younger people to come into the workforce. There are some remarkable things going on in the in this group right now. One out of six young people who are under the age of 21 who have graduated from high school are not actually working or in further education. That's 1 million people who have graduated from high school who are under 21 who are not working, looking for work, or in school. That's just remarkable. They're sitting around waiting, hoping that the recovery will catch up to them. A lot of them, they're with their parents. A few of them might be doing odd jobs that aren't going to be calculated. But that's a remarkable number when you think of how many people are being set behind by this recession and very slow recovery. These are people who are going to see for decades down the road lower wages, lower opportunities as a result of this recession and weak recovery.
But Michelle,
I just wanted to ask one question of Sudeep. You were telling, it used to be in the past that young people in that situation tended to be girls. And a lot of the speculation was they were getting ready to get married. People got married at a younger age. Now that's changed. Apparently this group is more likely to be boys. Is that correct?
And there are young men who are unemployed. There are a lot of factors driving that. There are more young women who, of course, are going to school and who are getting educated instead of starting families, which makes a big difference in all this.
Marilyn, you wanted to add?
This just brings us back to this wage issue, though. You know, when you think about what it takes to get to work, it not only takes job skills, but really you have to have some clothes. You have to be able to pay for a lunch. You have to be able to put gas in the car or however you need to get to work. In many cases, it's child care as well. So you have a lot of barriers to entry. And if you're only making $7.25 an hour, it may not add up for you to work. The last time the minimum wage was increased, the federal minimum wage, was exactly 5 years ago. It was July of 2009. Since that time, we've had a lot of inflation. For example, this very week, the average price for a gallon of gasoline is $3.70. That's the highest level we've seen coming into a 4th of July holiday weekend since 2008. So that's a high barrier to entering the workforce, is paying for all of that just to get to work. So really this business of adding more workers and then having to give some raises will actually start this process, one hopes, of healing this job market, of offering young people enough money to have the incentive to get back into the workforce and look for those jobs. So,
there's a lot of debate about that, Marilyn, because a lot of the people who are advocating against raising the minimum wage argue that it advantages current workers at the expense of potential workers like young people. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask, what are some of the developments on that story? You mentioned that the Gap, a large retailer, says that they're voluntarily raising their minimum wage. Any other news on that front?
Yes. About 20 states have raised the minimum wage. A lot of localities are doing that. Seattle recently raised its minimum wage, saying we're going to push it up to like $15 an hour over a couple of years. Other cities are doing likewise. So you're starting to see all around the country this push from the bottom of states, localities, and even individual employers saying we really do need to raise wages. But of course, that also, you know, when it's more expensive to hire somebody, maybe you don't hire as many. So it could also have a negative impact. It's a tricky thing to heal a job market that got as battered as this one did. There are a lot of different steps that have to be taken. The good thing about today's report is that we seem to be making those steps. We're sort of slowly climbing that rung out of this deep hole. And the news is encouraging, but as Sudeep certainly points out, there are many, many problems to still overcome.
Sudeep, finally, just, you're kind of at the nexus of this debate about the economy, kind of where you are. Tell us what some of the conversations that people are having with you and with your reporters about what needs to happen for the economy to really kind of pick up some steam.
What we've been waiting on all along is for companies to step up, to feel more confident about the recovery, that the conditions are going to remain robust. We're seeing that a bit, but there's still all these risks on the horizon, particularly overseas. Any global company has to look around, whether it's China or Russia or the Middle East, and you see a lot of trouble on the horizon. At home, you actually have to move from this phase of temporary support for the economy. We've all gone through the stimulus and the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates really low to doing things that will support growth in the longer run. These are the things we hear about all the time, like infrastructure, like immigration, overhauling the tax system, improving education. All of those things are stuck right now in our policy debates. You've got Congress moving very little on this front, and until you actually have a more meaningful progress on that front, you're not going to see the longer-term recovery that we want and at the pace we want.
Sudeep Reddy is an economics editor for The Wall Street Journal. Marilyn Giewax is NPR's senior business editor. Both joined us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you both for coming.
Thanks, Michelle.
Great to be with you.
By now, you've probably heard about the kidnapping and killing of three Israeli teenagers and all that has transpired because of it. The three young men, Ayel Yifra, Gilad Shair, and Naftali Frankel, were abducted June 12th as they hitchhiked home from their religious schools on the West Bank. The kidnapping has led to more violence. Five Palestinians were killed in clashes with authorities as they searched for the abducted boys. One Palestinian teenager, Mohammed Abu Qader, died in a gruesome killing earlier this week that is suspected to have been a revenge killing. Israel's prime minister has also condemned this as well. But Israel has been launching airstrikes aimed at the Gaza Strip because that area is dominated by the Palestinian group Hamas, which Israel's leaders blame for the kidnapping of the three Israeli teens. Leaders around the world, including U.S. President Barack Obama, have expressed their anguish over the deaths and especially for the pain of the parents. And that is a pain that members of Parent Circle Family Forum know all too well. Parent Circle is an organization comprised of more than 600 families, both Palestinians and Israelis, all of whom have lost a close family member as a result of the prolonged conflict. So we thought this would be a good time to speak with members of this group to hear their thoughts on a way forward out of this crisis. With us now are Robbie Damlin. She is Israeli and a spokesperson for Parent Circle. Her son David was killed by a Palestinian sniper in 2002. Also with us is Bassem Ahramin, who works with the Palestinian Office of Parents Circle. His daughter, Abir, was killed in 2007 by Israeli border police. And I thank you both for joining us, and I'm sorry for both of your losses.
Thank you.
Robbie, I wanted to start with you because it's said so often in this country, it's a cliche that, you know, you live in a tough neighborhood, meaning the, you know, the region where there has been so much violence in recent years. But it does seem as if this latest cycle seems particularly intense, and there just seems to be kind of a level of grief and rage that seems significant. I wanted to know, do you agree? Why do you think that is?
Oh, I think that it's much encouraged by the powers that be. And from the minute that these poor kids were kidnapped, there came out of it a rhetoric which was so frightening and so fear-creating that I think it worked up the whole nation, and also it had been going on for a couple of weeks. And of course, the media, I'm afraid to say, contribute a lot to creating fear. And of course, now the whole cycle of violence is once again in place. And we believe at the Parents Circle that there has to be a reconciliation framework in any future peace agreement. Because without that, we just have these temporary ceasefires until the next time.
Bassem, what about you? What strikes you about what is happening now and how your neighbors and how the countries are reacting to it?
You know, I said that the conflict didn't start with the kidnapping and the killing of the three young Israelis, unfortunately, which was a tragedy, and will not end by the kidnapping and murder Mohammed Abu Khdeir, unfortunately. And we didn't want to make it between Hamas and the Israeli nation. No, it's between the Palestinian people and the Israeli occupation. And this is the reactions about the occupation, the continue of the settlement and settlers, and you cannot talk about peace and build more settlements. But we said that in the parent circle, we need to be very clear that we will never go back to be victims to this violence again. We liberate ourselves. We know that we are the same people. The two people are the same people. It's the same blood. And we need to stop this madness, this killing.
Robbie, you were telling us that one of the things that you both are people who have said after your children were killed, with don't take revenge in the name of my son. I noted that there are family members of the three Israeli teens who have also made this statement, but there are a number of people, public actors, who are calling for revenge. And I wanted to ask, what do you think it is that has allowed you to call to stop this cycle of revenge and others are not?
I think that revenge is actually a very natural reaction to many things. I don't know. It's possibly my growing up in South Africa and being very influenced by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And actually, when the army came to tell me that David had been killed, apparently, and I really don't remember this, I said, "You may not kill anybody in the name of my child." And I knew very soon afterwards, when I was thinking about it, that this man didn't kill David because he was David. He killed him because he was a symbol of an occupying army. Please don't think that that is easy for me to say. But that is the truth. And when looking at that and realizing that maybe I could make a difference, the minute I met Palestinian mothers and recognized that we shared the same pain, then I knew that we could be this incredible force for making a difference. And so it's a choice that you make. You know, many parents die with their children when their children are killed. And many parents build libraries and statues and do wonderful things. And I don't criticize anybody. And I understand people who are stuck in their anger. But I do know that in my own path towards reconciliation, the minute that I gave up being a victim of the man who killed David, I was free. And that allows me to do this work, because I couldn't do this work if I wasn't willing to walk the walk with the man who killed my child.
Mm-hmm. Bassem, what about you? Your daughter, do I have this right? She was only 10 years old.
Yeah.
Yes, when she was killed. And what has allowed you to choose this course for yourself? One could see where you would be very angry. And as I understand it, in your youth, you were a fighter and you spent some time in prison as a consequence. What do you think has allowed you to take this course?
Yeah, it's everything about you, to be honest, push you for more violence, more revenge. But maybe Robbie said that there is no revenge. And because we love too much our kids, we don't want to take revenge in their name, on their behalf. The same thing when I said to the killer, or I call him a victim who killed my daughter in the Israeli court, that I need you to know that you are not a hero, you are not a warrior, you didn't kill the enemy or the terrorist, and you don't want to take revenge. And if you come to ask me to forgive you in the future, if you understand that you killed an innocent daughter, I will forgive you because I am strong, because I am free, because I understand that this teenager, he's a killer of my daughter, but he's not a war criminal. And we need to go back to our roots, to the humanity. I know the Israelis and the Palestinians, most of them, through the peace process, the majority support peace. Normal people, they want to live in peace and as neighbors.
We're speaking with two parents who've each lost a child in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They're now members of a parents group comprised both of Israeli and Palestinian parents who have lost a close relative in the conflict. Robbie, you know, this conflict now reaches far beyond the region. I mean, there were, where we are in Washington, D.C., there were, you know, prayer vigils immediately upon the discovery of the teenagers. And, you know, you can tell that there are people who feel a connection to this on both sides. Is there something that outsiders can do to be useful?
Well, firstly, there's one thing I ask everybody wherever I go. Please do not take sides. Please do not be pro-Israel. Do not be pro-Palestine. Because what you are doing is feeling very good about yourself. But what you are doing is importing our conflict into your country and creating hatred between Jews and Muslims. And that doesn't serve any purpose at all and certainly doesn't help us. And wouldn't it be extraordinary if instead of demonstrating and making prayers for one side, everybody would get together and pray for everybody on both sides? Because actually, if we can sit in the same room, if I can travel with Bassam all over the world and talk in the same voice, surely that should be some kind of example. We cannot share this land just with graves.
Bassam, final thought from you. Is there something that others can do to be helpful here, to be useful here?
Yeah, just to add two words to what Robbie said, absolutely, I agree with her. We need you to pray for us and don't forget us. We need you to educate yourself, to inform what happened exactly here. And this is what Martin Luther King says, that at the end we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Because we are going to solve this conflict, we will live in peace. Absolutely. It's not a matter of hope. This is the history. So absolutely we need your help and we need you with us. Thank you.
Bassam Aramin works with the Palestinian Office of Parents Circle. He joined us from Anata in East Jerusalem. Robbie Damlin is a spokesperson for Parents Circle Families with us from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for speaking with us, the both of you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're switching gears now to a much happier subject. Hopefully you've got your sparklers set, the legal ones, of course, the coolers filled and the hot dogs ready for the grill tomorrow, which will be July 4th, our nation's birthday. But our next guest says we actually celebrate it 2 days late or a month early. Joining us now for some fun Independence Day trivia is historian Kenneth C. Davis. He's author of the Don't Know Much About series of books, and he's with us once again. Welcome. Happy 4th to you.
Same to you, Michelle. It's always a great pleasure, and indeed, you're correct. We should have been celebrating the 2nd, as John Adams said we should, with pomp and parades and guns and illuminations, as he described them, by which he meant fireworks.
Why July 2nd? What happened here?
Well, John Adams was convinced it would be July 2nd because Congress had indeed voted on a resolution in favor of America's independence on July 2nd. And he wrote home to Abigail that night and told her so. But it was 2 days later that the Congress then took up Thomas Jefferson's draft version of the Declaration of Independence, which explained why America was declaring itself independent. They had simply passed a resolution on the 2nd, and on the 4th, they passed the document itself that explained why America should be free and independent. So we could celebrate the resolution of independence on the 2nd of July, but what we really celebrate is the Declaration of Independence, which came about on the 4th of July.
What do you think we should do? We should spread it out. We should have 2 days of barbecues.
Well,
three,
we could make it a movable feast, 3 days.
Okay,
really
three
stretch
days.
It out and celebrate in proper fashion.
Well, talking signatures, contrary to what I think a lot of people believe, George Washington was not a signer of the Declaration of Independence, correct?
He was not a signer of the Declaration. He wasn't there. Washington had left Philadelphia a full year earlier when he had been named commander-in-chief of what was then the 1st United States Army. At that time, they were surrounding the British in Boston, eventually forced them out. Washington moves the army to New York, expecting that the British will make their next big move on New York, and he was correct in that. It took until July 9th for the declaration text to reach Washington in New York, and the troops cheered, and they apparently went out and tore down a statue of King George III, melted it down, according to legend, and turned it into bullets that were then used in the Revolution.
Now, we were talking earlier about the fact that a lot of people seem to have forgotten that George Washington was also a slave owner. But you were telling us that a draft of the Declaration of Independence mentioned slavery, but it was eventually left out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
This is a very important idea. A year before the Declaration is announced and before independence, the famous Dr. Johnson in England had written an essay about America in which he said, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes?" And it's a reminder that most of the men in Philadelphia were slaveholders themselves or had something to do with slavery. Jefferson writes a draft of the Declaration, which is debated for 2 days in Congress, and they delete a section that he had written in which he claimed that the King of England, King George III, was responsible for the slave trade and keeping America from stopping it, which was completely untrue, but it's stricken from the Declaration. Jefferson later writes it was stricken out of deference to the men who owned slaves as well as those who were making a good deal of money transporting them. And it is a reminder that these men who are talking about liberty and equality were mostly slaveholders. Mm-hmm. Even Benjamin Franklin and Dr. Benjamin Rush, who became early abolitionists in Philadelphia, owned slaves themselves. So it's this strange contradiction. It's a question that Dr. Johnson asked 235 years ago, and we're still really not sure of a good answer today.
If you're just joining us, we're digging in on some July 4th history. Our guest is Kenneth C. Davis. He's author of the Don't Know Much About series of books. So let's talk a little bit about how we celebrate. We often hear the saying, as American as apple pie, and I know that I'm working on my apple pie creation for the holiday, which I'm quite proud of. But when did apples become part of it? Apples aren't indigenous to North America, are they?
No, it's a curious phrase that has become part of the language. American as apple pie, we use it all the time. But the apple wasn't a particularly American fruit. They'd been around and in Europe for a long time. But it just seems to have come down as the quintessential American meal. So I don't know. I suppose if we go back to Washington and that phony cherry tree story, maybe we should really be having cherry pie on the 4th of July.
I think so. But what about hot dogs and hamburgers? Any idea how those became part of our July 4th picnic?
This really relates to a very important idea that we should talk about in a serious way about the Declaration of Independence, which is how much of America really comes from our immigrant roots. Of course, we think of hot dogs and hamburgers, but they're traditionally thought of as Frankfurters from Frankfurt, Germany, and hamburgers from Hamburg, Germany. So part of the culinary contribution of the immigrant fathers. 9 of the 56 signers of the Declaration were immigrants themselves, recent immigrants. Thomas Jefferson writes in the Declaration about the importance of immigration. So it's particularly interesting, ironic, that at the very moment we're talking about liberty and independence and this history, we have people shouting, you know, go home at buses of migrants. And we're having this debate about immigration, and it's been around as long as the Republic has been. After the establishment of the Constitution, there was a great deal of concern about Italians, Spanish, French immigrants, because they were seen as dangerous. So even though we like to think of ourselves as the nation of immigrants, it's been part of our political DNA from the very beginning.
Well, thank you for that. Before we let you go, I have a bit of trivia for you. Did you know that there's a first daughter birthday on the 4th of July?
I didn't know about a first daughter birthday.
Yes, but July 4th is also Malia Obama's birthday. So maybe this is a good time to wish her a happy sweet 16.
A birthday she shares, by the way, with Calvin Coolidge, the only president born on the 4th of July.
Okay. Kenneth C. Davis is an historian and author of the Don't Know Much About series of books. He was nice enough to join us from our bureau in New York City. So happy July 4th to you, Kenneth C. Davis.
Go and pursue happiness.
Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop. We know it's Thursday, but in advance of the holiday, we thought this would be a good time to get together, get a little shape up right before the holiday. The guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their mind. So sitting in the chairs this week are writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar, founder of themuslimguide.com, is with us from Chicago. Healthcare consultant, a contributor to National Review Online, Neil Minkoff, is with us from Boston. And right here in Washington, D.C., Corey Dade, contributing editor for The Root. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas.
Hey,
welcome
hey,
to the
hey.
Show. How we doing?
What's up? Happening, man? What's cracking?
Living it.
Come on. Get happy. This barbecue is your future and your immediate future. Happy early Independence Day.
Yes, indeed. Well,
America.
America, indeed. Since the U.S. is out of the World Cup, let's bring things home right to Cleveland. As it turns out, somebody...
All roads lead to Cleveland. Mm-hmm. All politics.
Go ahead, Jimmy.
Have your moment.
They don't? Okay, well, Kyrie Irving is not the only guy excited about the $19 million deal with the Cleveland Cavaliers. Corey Dade, CD, you think he's worth the money? Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's definitely worth the money. He is he is probably the best young point guard in the Eastern Conference. All due respect to John Wall, the best point guards in the West, so he has no competition there. But, you know, he had another year left on his contract, so he had nowhere to go. He had no deals to make. His issue is staying healthy. And now that they just drafted Andrew Wiggins out of University of Kansas, that could be a dynamic duo. So he has every incentive to stay put for now.
Well, that is a big issue, though, CD, staying healthy. I don't play ball, and my hand hurts, and my knee is going out. But of course, I do box, so there's that. Dr. Neil, LeBron James reportedly wants a short-term contract of $22 million. Will he get it from the Heat, and should Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade take pay cuts to make it happen?
Are you going to make me say nice things about LeBron?
Yes. do it. So go out of your comfort zone, man.
He's worth way more than that. It shows actually tremendous. I can't believe I have to say these things. It shows a real championship spirit amongst the others that they would take a pay cut to facilitate having the best player in the world continue to lead them to championships. He is worth a tremendous amount more than that for that team. What they do have is they have Pat Riley by the short hairs because, you know, theoretically, according to the news reports, they all have structured deals in places that haven't been signed and a list of free agents that he's expected to go get. But if he doesn't produce, he doesn't necessarily get the big three back. They have all the leverage there, and he's worth more than that. He is.
Wow.
Well, it also shows the benefits of working together. I mean, it was reported. Do you remember that the sitcom Friends? Well, it was reported that one of the reasons that these guys were able to be as well compensated as they were is that they all worked together in concert, that they were all willing to discuss and all work together as a team, and they were able to negotiate their deal as a team, which is one of the reasons they were able to. So I think that's one of the interesting developments here is that these three guys are, if reports are correct, working as a team. I don't know, Arsene, what do you think? Go ahead.
Anyway. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, here you had, you know, essentially three mercenaries who are willing to opt out of their contracts, take a lower pay to try and bring a fourth potential mercenary, maybe a Pau Gasol from the Los Angeles Lakers initially thought, maybe point guard Kyle Lowry, but he ended up re-signing with Toronto. What I found interesting about this whole free agent sweepstakes was Carmelo Anthony recently went to Texas. He went to both Dallas and Houston, to see what they had to offer. And what was really interesting is when he went to Houston, outside the Toyota Center, they had a huge picture of Carmelo Anthony in a Houston Rockets number 7 jersey. But the problem is that the number 7 jersey of the Houston Rockets currently belongs to Jeremy Lin. And so it was kind of a slap in the face to Jeremy Lin, you know, to have this huge poster of Melo outside basically saying that, you know, your days here are numbered. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how NBA free agency ultimately pans out.
Well, that was wrong. That was not. But what are you going to do? It's like the trailer rule in Hollywood, right? You know how big is your trailer and
Jeremy
how close
Lin,
is it to the set?
Jeremy Lin needs to put on his big boy pants. He knows what time it is. He knew he wasn't going to last beyond this season with that team. They were going to deal him anyway.
Yeah, but you put some other number on there, dude. You don't put your guy's number up there with a new man. With a guy who hasn't even signed.
It's a business. It's a business. They have no loyalty to these players, especially Jeremy Lin.
I know. Like, why did you call the players mercenaries? How about strong strategic thinkers? I mean, what's up with that? Like, why are they mercenaries when, you know what I mean? What? Why are
well, we've had this discussion before, Michelle. You and I are not going to agree.
Okay, all right.
From sports.
That
music.
Was very mature of you, Arsene. Thank you for
sports. Can we move from sports to music, please? Because clearly haters are going to hate. But we got to give props to Robin Thicke for laying it on kind of thick, I guess. The singer's new album is titled Paula. He's trying to get his woman back. Can we drop the clip, please? Wow. He's caught a lot of flack, and also it's drawn in like an imperfect analog to Marvin Gaye's Here, My Dear, which was actually part of the divorce settlement he made. He was just like saying, here, my dear, take this. This is your album. But anyway, so this is a different thing, but I'm going to stick up for my boy Thicke, man. I mean, I say, you know, the romantic is dead, and I think it's really kind of sick that we know we punish men for being too masculine, then we punish them for being too romantic. And I feel like Robin's catching a lot of flack for trying to get Paula Patton back. I mean, I didn't mean for that to rhyme, but hey, it just happens all the time. Corey Day, you're not so optimistic, are you?
Yeah, I think I just threw up a little bit in my mouth.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I give props to any man who's willing to show, you know, his sensitivities and is willing to do whatever he can to get his woman back. Word. But, you know, let's not go too far. I mean, here's a line from one of his songs called the song Lock the Door. At least open the doggy door, throw a friend a juicy bone. That is the extent of his romantic, you know, expertise here. If that's what he's dealing with, you know what? He can kiss that goodbye. I mean, I think there's a difference between...
Is it that it's lame, or is it that the lyrics are lame and simplistic, or is it that the total picture, like his behavior at the Music Awards with that dance with Miley Cyrus, which took place in front of her, that a lot of people thought was just a bit much? I mean, what is it, the total picture? Is it the album itself is lame, in your view? What is it?
Well,
because begging has a very long history in R&B, okay? Yeah, like, I don't think there would be an R&B without begging.
Yeah, I mean, the please, please, baby, baby, please. I mean, that's part of the DNA of R&B.
Yeah.
So that's all good. But when you are begging in a way that, you know, goes to this level, first of all, the lyrics are lame. I mean, he is the creepy crooner at this point. To me,
Oh, come on.
Yeah, there's the analogy. Okay, there's the analogy of him. You know, it's like on Facebook when you're posting things to get public sympathy, it seems like the public display is about his narcissism in promoting an album more than a sincere effort to actually go after his wife. Why don't you talk to her directly?
You know what this is? You know what this is, CD? I don't mean to cut you off, but he's trying to live that very sincere, that very serious R&B singer life. And on some level, he's being punished for trying to front like he's a black R&B singer, when in fact, he's just kind of a white guy that sings black. You know, he's trying to live all that life, because really, what black R&B singers do best, from Sam Cooke to Barry White to R. Kelly, they beg for the women back. That's what they do best.
But you know what? I go to Daryl Hall and John Oates. I go to Simply Red. There are all kinds of quote-unquote blue-eyed soul singers who actually do it authentically. And I think what's missing here is the authenticity that comes across to the audience. There's nothing that seems sincere about this album. He said he put this album together in 2 weeks, and it shows.
Neil, what do you think?
So, this is going to sound like a cop-out, but I had never heard of Robin Thicke before Blurred Lines. I didn't expect to hear much from him again. I think it says something so bizarre about our celebrity-laced society that we're having a conversation about this not particularly, you know, the somewhat obscure singer's divorce and whether or not he's oversharing. I personally think it's creepy. I personally think there, from what I've read, there's way too much personal detail that his wife probably wouldn't want released than the average American to know about. But I think it says more about who we are as a society that we even care.
Interesting point. Go ahead. Arsene, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I co-signed everything that Neil and Corey just said. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's, if the question is it romantic or is it lame? It's both. It's romantically lame. I think that I think he took it too far. He had a Twitter hashtag called Ask Thicke, where the public just, you know, essentially, you know, lambasted him for this whole, you know, experiment. And I think that, you know, if you're going to get your woman back, that's, you know, that is to be commended. I have no problem with that. But again, like Corey said, to sort of do it in this manner was a romantically lame way of doing it.
If you're just joining us, we're having our weekly barbershop roundtable with writer Jimmy Israel, Professor Arsalan Iftikhar, journalist Corey Dade, healthcare consultant Neil Minkoff. So let me ask you all about something that's, you know, Neil, you pointed out the fact that sometimes the kind of the urgent drives out the important. The celebrity drives out the important. I know that you were very interested in a topic we discussed earlier in the program today. We talked a lot about it's been a very important topic, the killing of the three Israeli teenagers, and a lot has happened as a consequence of it. There is a suspected revenge killing. There have been, you know, military strikes. There have been, you know, airstrikes in Gaza. There have been, you know, Palestinians killed in rock-throwing incidents with the police who were searching for these boys. And I just wondered, if I could just ask you what you make of this. I mean, Arsalan, part of your career has been kind of trying to address these issues and address them in a human way. Do you have some response to this that you'd wanted to share?
Yeah, you know, Michelle, it was interesting. Earlier last week, I was at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and I got a chance to actually sit down with former Israeli ambassador Michael Oren. We were at a picnic table together for about an hour when the news of these three teenagers was starting to break. And Ambassador Oren and I, you know, were just talking to each other about how important it was to humanize the other to each other. You know, when Israelis die, we tend to see, you know, Israelis stand up and mourn for them. When Palestinians die, we see the same on that side. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge the humanity in one another and you know, call out the tragedy when three, you know, young Israeli teenagers are murdered, or when a Palestinian teenager is murdered in retaliation. I think we need to, you know, sort of look beyond our own comfort zones and bring the humanity out in one another. And that's something that, you know, sadly has been a part of this whole violence, beginning violence in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Neil, what about you? Does this kind of hit home for you in some way?
Yeah, of course it does. I mean, as an American Jew and as a parent, it hits home. I mean, to me, it's so convoluted. Do the military strikes come after the rockets are fired, or the rockets come after the military strikes? And is right. the kidnapping and killing a result, a reaction to a military strike, or is that a reaction to a rocket being fired? But even before we can get to an idea of two people sitting down and talking about peace, we almost need like this cooling off period. Like, can we just have a month where nothing bad happens so that we can just hit the reset button and not every action is a result of is a reaction to something that's already occurred? We need this cooling off period to prevent another military strike or another intifada, and be able to have a period where there is a true reset button so that everything can start fresh again.
Corey, can I just ask you this? Because I know that one of your portfolios is covering politics. You know, we saw a recent poll from a credible organization show that 33% of American voters think Obama is the worst president since World War II. And I just have to ask whether part of not this, but other kind of chaos in other parts of the world or these very troubling situations is part of what's contributing to that, and whether you feel that he's exerted leadership on this issue appropriately.
I don't think there's any statistical significance in the polls to tie sort of his poll, you know, plummeting to his foreign policy. I think what you see is Americans are tired of sort of U.S. engagement in Iraq and Afghanistan. They generally, and polls show this too, they generally want the U.S. to pull back from these engagements, and they're war weary. And then the other big thing is when it comes to American politics and how voters think, voters are very hardly ever influenced significantly by foreign policy. Mm. And so, especially in an off election year, it's just not they're two separate and distinct things.
Mm, interesting. Well, let's end on a high note, though. As we mentioned, we're having the barbershop on Thursday because we figure you might want to make an early exit for the weekend. We do have a program tomorrow, but we're going to let you guys get your barbecue on early. So, what are you guys doing for the holiday? Anybody want to let me know? What are you doing, Corey?
I am going to the birthplace of, I guess we call it the birthplace of America, where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Where else to go than that to celebrate America's independence? Going to Philly. Take my daughter up there.
Awesome.
Really, it's just an excuse to see my favorite band, The Roots, kick it for free.
Well, I think your daughter will enjoy that time with you. Neil, I understand you have a yearly tradition.
Yes, we do the same three things every year, and they're hokey, and you guys can make fun of me if you want. We read the Declaration of Independence together as a family. We tell the story about Hancock and Adams passing away 50 years later on the 4th of July, and we go to our little small-town parade and watch the floats go by and watch the Revolutionary War reenactors fire off their muskets.
Very, very,
wow.
Very nice. I think it was Jefferson, wasn't it? Jefferson and Adams on the same
day? Isn't that what I said?
You said Hancock, John Hancock.
Oh, sorry.
Jefferson.
I meant Jefferson.
Okay. All right. Well, you'll rehearse that before you read the Declaration of Independence. I know you will. Arsalan, our friend, it's Ramadan. So
it is. Yeah,
the barbecue's going to have to happen late, right?
Yeah. So the 7 million American Muslims, we're going to have to wait for our halal hamburgers until sunset on this 4th of July.
Okay. But you're going to have one though, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Jimmy, what about you?
Michelle, I'm going to try to get through it like I try to get through every day. It's going to be Hot Sauce Williams for one. That's it. That's my life.
Oh.
Sorry.
We'll throw some extra.
Jimmy, come visit. Come to the parade with
him. Help him read the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, Jimmy.
Get the names right, you know.
Uh-huh.
He's a writer. I mean, you know, he's the editor. He cares about stuff like that. Oh, well.
Here we go.
I hope everybody has a happy and safe 4th. Jimmy Israel.
And the same to you.
Oh, thank you. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Neil Minkoff is a healthcare consultant and contributor to National Review Online. Corey Dade is a contributing editor for The Root. And Arsalan Iftikhar is founder of TheMuslimGuide.com and an adjunct professor of religious studies at DePaul University. Thank you all so much.
America.
Yes, sir.
Yep.
And remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast that's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Happy Independence Day, everybody.